Good morning. Oops. Good morning. I'm going to call this hearing Tuesday, March 18th of the Minnesota House of Representatives State Government Finance and Policy Committee. Co-Chair Cleavorn, have you had a chance to review the minutes from March 13th? And would you like to move them? Chair Cleavorn moves the minutes. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Minutes are adopted. Okay. On the agenda today, is Representative Van Binsbergen here? That's what's the problem with freshmen. They wander off. They get all excited and go tell people about their bills. Okay, well, in that case, we'll just move to Chair Anderson, and we'll just move his House File 1377 up the stack. Chair Anderson, once you get there, if you'd like to move 1377 to come before the committee, it is going to be laid over for possible inclusion. Jones here. Mr. Chair, go ahead and move your bill.
I would just add that Representative Van Binsbergen's son plays in the state basketball tournament today, so he's pretty excited, and so we have to give him some space today. But anyway. Yeah, I'd like to move House File 1377, Mr. Chair and members. This provides some funding for public television in the state. It has a long history of serving Minnesota with educational, cultural, and public affairs programming. The system includes multiple stations that provide content tailored to different regions of Minnesota. Six stations in all, Twin Cities TPT based in St. Paul, the Pioneer out in my area, serving southwestern Minnesota, based in Granite Falls. We have Lakeland up in the northern Minnesota, and PBS North in Duluth, public television station, southern Minnesota, KSMQ and Prairie Public Station, based in North Dakota, but also serving northwestern Minnesota. Mr. Chair, we provided funding to public television through matching grants, equipment grants, and block grants, and through this committee, the legislature has funded public television with matching and small equipment grants, but these block grants have not been increased since 2013, and this bill does include an increase in those grants. And block grants have been supported by the committee as well. They were reinstated 2 years ago after being suspended over 10 years ago. So, Mr. Chair, we have a couple of testifiers to tell us more about public television, and I'd like to call on those now, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Anderson. If you, Mr. Heen, are you going first, or who's going first? All right, introduce yourself for the record. Please proceed.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Nash, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Les Heen, and I represent the Minnesota Public Television Association. I'd just like to say that one of the things we like to remind folks about with public television is that we do things differently with public television in Minnesota, because in many other states, public television operates as part of a public university or a quasi-state agency or a statewide organization with a lot of the infrastructure that goes along with a state agency or a public university. But in Minnesota, what we have is different. We have six regional nonprofits, and they're all community licensees, as we call them. And that means that they're based in communities with local boards, local decisions about what kind of programs we do and how we serve our communities. And that's an important part of our identity and who we are, and we think it really makes a better deal for the viewers and citizens of Minnesota and for the taxpayers. And with that, I have with me today, I'd like to turn things over, if I may, to Patty Mester, who is the general manager of one of those stations. She's the CEO of PBS North in Duluth, and Ms. Mester is also the president of the Minnesota Public Television Association.
Ms. Mester, please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Nash and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Patty Mester. I'm president of the Minnesota Public Television Association. At our station at PBS North in Duluth and at every public television station across Minnesota, we share a fundamental mission, serving lifelong learners of all ages. We begin as what was then called educational television, dedicated to helping children master basic skills, and that mission continues today. About one-third of our primary channel's daily schedule is devoted to high-quality, non-commercial educational programs that help children build essential skills in reading, math, science, and problem-solving. This is critical because in some of Minnesota's most rural communities, approximately 55% of children do not attend preschool. Our programs serve as an essential bridge, supporting parents, their children's first teachers, and helping prepare kids for kindergarten and beyond. But our educational work reaches far beyond the home. More than 20% of Minnesota teachers use our content in the classroom. The impact of this work is measurable. Children who watch PBS programming consistently score 8 to 10% higher than those who do not. That's real progress, and it's made possible by the partnerships we build with communities throughout the state. State grants are fundamental to our ability to serve children, families, and learners of all ages. These operating grants and matching grants are matching grants requiring us to raise funds locally before receiving state support. By law, these grants must be matched with funds from Minnesota-based contributors. This requirement ensures that every station stays deeply connected to the communities we serve, strengthening the bond of trust that we've built over the decades. Our station in Duluth, Minnesota is over 60 years old. Matching and block grants are the backbone of our operations. They support everything from equipment to paying utilities. Equipment grants are equally vital, helping us maintain the expensive transmitters, towers, and computer systems that keep our free, high-quality content accessible to all Minnesotans. Like you, we face challenges brought by technological changes, and for example, software licenses that were once considered capital expenses are now operating expenses, shifting our financial burden from capital expenditures to operational costs. We take our accountability to the public and the state seriously. For more than 50 years, all of our stations have undergone independent annual audits with findings included in our grant reporting. And every 2 years, we submit documentation to the state to recertify our eligibility for these grants. We're also proud of our longstanding partnership with the legislature, providing statewide distribution of legislative television for more than 15 years. And all of our over-the-air programs and online content remain free to the public. Whether you have an antenna or an internet connection, you have access to our programs. The MPTA stations are constantly evolving to meet the needs of Minnesotans. We've built our system to be accessible across multiple platforms and through multiple avenues. In other words, we are building the sidewalks where people want to walk. And the final point I want to leave you with is this. State grants are not investments to us, they are investments through us. These funds go right back into our communities in ways that would not be possible otherwise. They help us deliver educational opportunities, cultural enrichment, and trusted content to Minnesotans everywhere. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today. I am happy to answer any questions.
Okay, we will move to member questions. Members, don't all rush at once. Well, Representative Anderson, I'll say that public television the children's programming is very important to me. Mr. Heen knows that. You know that. As you may have learned yesterday, I grew up as an abused kid, and Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood was foundational for me. And I can say that co-chair Cleavorn and I have provided funding for this in the past, and we've prioritized other things. I hope that we can, but we don't know what our targets are going to be. We don't know what that number looks like. But we will do our level best to get to a place where we can provide some level of assistance. So Chair Cleavorn, any comments?
No, I would just like to say thank you for the great work that you do, Mr. Chair. You and I agree that this is really an important program, and we were very happy in 2023 to bring these grants back. So hopefully we'll continue that bipartisan work and move forward. Thank you.
Representative Anderson, closing words.
Mr. Chair, I can't say much more than that. Public television provides a great service to our state, educational, public affairs, arts, culture, and history, and also some emergency broadcasting and public safety as well. So I encourage support by the Committee of Minnesota's Public Television. Thank you much.
Thank you, Representative Anderson. And with that, 1377 is laid over for possible inclusion. Okay, we will revert to the top of our agenda. We will call up Representative Van Binsbergen for House File 1458. While he is Moving up to the testifiers table, let the record show he brought snacks, both healthy and less than healthy. And since he is not a member of the committee, I will move House File 1458 to come before the committee. And Representative Van Binsbergen, I understand you have an A1 amendment.
I do.
I will move the A1 to put the bill in the shape that the author desires. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The amendment is adopted. Representative Van Binsbergen, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And for those that haven't testified before, we'll call on you to ask you to introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony. And as you get questions from the committee, we always speak through the chair. So, Representative Van Binsbergen, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My apology, I was a little bit late here this morning. My son's playing basketball tonight, and so I've been dealing with trying to get him on course for his basketball game tonight. So if you're available, he's playing at 8 o'clock tonight. So anyway, my name is Scott Van Binsbergen. I'm state representative from House District 16A, which is about 2 hours straight west of here. I'm introduced to you today, House File 1458. It's a bill that it addresses the shortages that we've been having with CPAs here in Minnesota. It's a bipartisan bill. It's got support on both sides of the aisle. It's got the AICP and NASBA are on board. I'll give you a little more background. This was introduced last year, a bill similar, and there was some opposition to it. But since then, national groups have gotten on board, and they've shifted their positions. And they're now, they support alternative paths to CPA licensureship. In fact, there's been three states recently, Ohio, Utah, and Virginia, that have passed similar legislation. And there's 20 other states that have legislation pending currently. House File 1458 addresses concerns about CPA licensureship requirements, which mandate 150 hours of college education and 1 year work experience. But what might be interesting to you is there isn't very good structure that's required after reaching your bachelor's degree at 120. So there's an extra 30 hours in there that students are absorbing, and they're absorbing that debt and that time away from possibly getting a job a year earlier. And those last 30 credits or 30 hours are, they're not taking classes that are applicable to a CPA licensureship or accounting. So they're taking, a lot of them are taking classes that aren't even at the college that they're attending. Research has also indicated that these requirements have led, all the requirements that we have led to a 15% decline in students pursuing a CPA career. And it's also had a disproportionate effect economically on disadvantaged communities. A couple more key items about House File 1458. It introduces alternative pathways to CPA licensureship. A bachelor's degree with 2 years of general work experience, a master's degree with 1 year of general work experience, all while retaining the current path of 150 hours and 1 year of experience, but that is due to sunset in 2030 for current enrolled students. All pathways maintain they maintain the requirements to pass the CPA exam, which you all know is it's a heavy lift. This also, in Section 2 of this bill, it defines education and experience requirements post-transition period, and is which is defined in the A2 amendment. This bill also establishes a transitional period and specifies when the Board of Accountancy must issue CPA licenses. It also, this bill enables automatic mobility for CPAs. CPAs licensed in good standing in other states will now be able to serve Minnesotans while adhering to the Minnesota laws and rules and regulations. There's been, and there's also going to be a shift in the licensing authority from NASBA, which is a national organization, to the Minnesota Board of Accountancy. It'll operate similar to how a driver's license works across state lines. This bill repeals NASBA's authority, leaving the Minnesota Board of Accountancy as the sole licensing entity. This bill addresses barriers identified in academic studies, including the high costs of additional education as a deterrent to prospective CPAs. Also, research shows no improvement in CPA work quality since implementing the 150-hour requirement nearly two decades ago. This will simplify the entire licensure process, all while standing and strengthening behind the CPA exam. So I'm going to turn it over to my testifiers, the experts here. Turn it over to you, Stephanie.
Thank you. Right,
please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Stephanie Markert, and I am a principal at CLA, and happy to be here today. Thank you.
Please proceed.
Co-chair and committee members, I'm Stephanie Markert, principal in CLA Minneapolis office. As a firm, our roots date back more than 70 years in Minnesota to our founding in 1953. CLA employs more than 1,000 people in the state of Minnesota. We're the largest public accounting firm in the state, and we have 10 offices across the state. We strongly support House File 1458, introduced by Representative Van Binsbergen and co-authors, to address the critical CPA shortage. The bill is crucial for licensing, workforce development, and public protection. The demand for CPA services is growing while the supply for CPAs is shrinking. And so our Minnesota offices handle over 24,000 tax returns right now and 3,200 assurance or audit engagements annually. To meet this increasing demand, we're embracing technology and new professional pathways. However, this does not replace the need for new CPAs, expertise, and those client relationships. Creating additional pathways will attract more students to accounting while maintaining the high standards as they have to sit for the CPA exam, which has an initial pass rate of 50%. We value on-the-job training and mentoring over this unrelated coursework. Our internship program is crucial for building out our talent pipeline, and we're actually seeing a decline in our interns who want to take a full-time position because they are so focused on getting those 150 hours, including the 30 that are unrelated to accounting. The nonprofit sector, so we think about our communities, it's our largest practice in Minnesota. It contributes significantly to the state's economy, supporting 385,000 jobs, 13% of the workforce. With 4,200 nonprofits that require annual audits, the CPA shortage makes this task more challenging and costly. Additional pathways to CPA licensure will better serve the public by ensuring adequate oversight and assurance of public and private funds. Passing file, House File 1458 is critical to our profession's future and meeting our community's needs. By reintroducing pathways similar than those from two decades ago, we're modernizing to meet the current demands. This change will strengthen our profession and bring in a new generation of CPAs ready to serve our workforce and our communities. Thank you for your time, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Next testifier, if you'd introduce yourself for the record and proceed, and then we'll ask you to slide out, and I know that there are others that we have. We have Ms. Metcalf, Boz Bostrom, Bob Cedergren, Cap O'Rourke, and Julie Blaha, State Auditor. So as you finish your testimony, if you'd make room for the next.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Ms. Metcalf is not going to be testifying. She had a flight that she had to catch this morning.
Very good. Thank you. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Good morning. My name is Bob Cedergren. Co-chairs and members of the committee, I'm a past chair of the Minnesota Society of CPA Board of Directors. I've been a CPA for 37 years, and I currently am a partner at Wifley, a top 25 CPA firm. I support House File 1458 and thank Representative Van Binsbergen and the co-authors for carrying this bill. Throughout my career, I've seen the profession change significantly. Earning a CPA credential is a commitment, and rightfully so, given the financial complexities that CPAs navigate. The work of CPAs is so impactful that every state regulates the profession. We support and work with state regulators whose role is to protect the public interest. I can tell you from my own experience and through conversations with colleagues throughout the country and members of the Minnesota Society of CPAs that we have a significant shortage of CPAs today. Currently, as you heard, the additional 30 college credits beyond the bachelor's degree have not proven to have worked as intended when passed nearly 20 years ago, and it has created unnecessary barriers for those wanting to become CPAs. The additional 30 credits are estimated to cost candidates an additional $25,000 on average, plus delayed entry into the workforce costing an additional $75,000 in lost wages. House File 1458 would allow candidates to have to use a bachelor's degree with 2 years of experience or a master's degree with 1 year of experience. The current option of 150 college credits with 1 year of experience would also remain through the transition period, as you heard. It is important to note, again, that all candidates must still be required to pass the CPA exam. Studies by the University of Chicago, MIT, Utah State University, and the Center for Audit Quality all consistently show the 150 credit requirement reduces the number of candidates who select accounting as a major, which has led to the decline in the number of CPAs that we currently have. Last year, Minnesota was the only state with active legislation. Today, more than 20 states have active legislation, with another 15 states expected to introduce legislation this year. As Representative Van Binsbergen mentioned, 3 states, Ohio, Utah, and Virginia, have already passed similar legislation. You also heard about CPA mobility and what effect the changes could have for Minnesota CPAs. Mobility is the ability to practice across state lines without applying for a CPA certificate in each state, similar to what a driver's license does. The bill will create automatic mobility and allow CPAs from other states to serve clients in Minnesota if the CPA is licensed and in good standing in their home state. Those CPAs will be under the jurisdiction of the Minnesota Board of Accountancy and subject to Minnesota law. I recently served on a national licensure task force formed by the National Association of the State Boards of Accountancy to evaluate the licensure requirements while working to maintain mobility. And Minnesota was credited with being a leader in addressing the pipeline issue and shortage of CPAs. Both the American Institute of CPAs and NASBA are now supportive of additional pathways to CPA licensure and have endorsed a plan similar to House File 1458. Thank you, co-chairs and members of the committee, for your consideration, and I am happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. If you would introduce yourself for the record, and we'll have our next testifier slide into the open seat. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Boz Bostrom. Good morning, co-chairs and members of the committee. I'm Boz Bostrom. I am the current chair of the Minnesota Society of CPA Board of Directors. We are a professional organization representing 7,500 members who work in accounting. When we come to the Capitol, we're representing not just ourselves, but the thousands of clients we serve, individuals and small businesses, Fortune 500 and 1,000 companies, nonprofits, and governmental agencies. I've also been an accounting prof at St. Ben's and St. John's for the past 21 years, and prior to becoming a prof, I worked in public accounting for 9 years. I support House File 1458 and thank Representative Binsbergen and the co-authors for carrying this bill. The demand for accountants continues to rise while the supply of accountants is declining. You've heard that. Well, over a recent six-year period, the number of new candidates taking the CPA exam fell by over 30%. Now, a significant barrier to enrollment in our accounting programs is the current licensure requirement, which mandates an additional 30 credits beyond the standard bachelor's degree. The students are recognizing the CPA licensure as the gold standard, but many simply cannot afford to take the time or pay that extra cost in order to achieve those additional 30 credits. Academic research has shown that the requirement has not resulted in better prepared CPAs. And I would say, even as an educator, that an extra year of on-the-job training is far more valuable than forcing students to take an additional 30 credits beyond a standard bachelor degree. And in fact, because of that, at St. Ben's and St. John's, our curriculum, we prepare students to take the CPA exam with a bachelor's degree, but then in practice, we advise students to earn those extra 30 credits through low-cost community college courses. Courses like online personal fitness, online fitness walking, photography, canoeing, and even yoga. Yeah, that just doesn't make any sense. It is important to note that more than 40 states, including Minnesota, allow CPA candidates to sit for the exam at 120 college credits. But then after taking the exam and passing the exam, they may have to get those additional 30 credits in such courses as the ones that I just listed. Now, some may argue that an additional pathway to licensure might reduce the quality of work. There's just no data or research to support that claim. That's why there's no opposition here today. We've done all of our work based on data and based on the research. So in closing, House File 1458, it's going to eliminate an additional barrier to entry while maintaining that rigorous requirement of passing the CPA exam. So thank you, co-chairs and committee members, and I'd also be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Next, we have Capo O'Rourke, and if Auditor Blaha would come up and take the open seat. Mr. O'Rourke, please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Capo O'Rourke. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Association of Small Cities. We advocate on behalf of the over 700 cities with populations under 5,000. I'd also like to say for the record that I am a St. John's graduate of 98 and former teammate of Mr. Bostrom, although during my time at St. John's, no one ever told me to take yoga classes. I will say, so on behalf of small cities, we are in strong support of this bill, and want to thank Representative Van Binsbergen. And we have an issue, and I think small cities are kind of the canary in the coal mine in this issue, is that we are seeing a significant lack of CPAs and auditors. We have cities across the state that have not only seen significant increases in the costs of their audits as they put out RFPs, but frankly, we have a number of small cities that have just put out RFPs with no responses whatsoever. The talent pool that is out there and the available resources for our small communities is getting harder and harder. And there are a number of factors, and this is a help in the step in the right direction, but it's not the magic bullet. And as I see Representative Olson over there, we have other legislation that will come to address this issue, but this is a key issue in getting more young people into this industry and into this field, that so our cities and other people that are using CPAs have a greater talent pool from which to work from. Because right now, the industry is just seeing too many people leaving, whether it be retirement or otherwise, and not enough, they're not replacing those. And it's having major effects on a lot of our small cities and communities across the state.
Thank you, Mr. O'Rourke. Auditor Blaha, welcome back to the committee. If you would, officially introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Nash. Thank you, members. My name is Julie Blaha. I'm your state auditor and in strong favor of this bill as well. I really want to thank the representative for bringing it forward. What we're seeing in our office is the effects of the shortage firsthand. Right now, the national stat that you hear the most is that today, 75% of all CPAs could retire. They could all walk out. 75% could walk out today. And that is making this such a major issue across the country. Now, we have plenty of local indicators as well. There isn't a week that goes by that we don't get a panicked call into our office at trying to find an auditor. In fact, we had one unit up north that called in and said, I've tried 19 entities and have not yet gotten a bid. And so this is definitely becoming an issue. And if that isn't compelling, we even have people who were formerly, some of the people who, some of you have been here a little bit, remember a time when there was a big discussion about the authority of my office to do county audits. Well, some of those very people that testified in favor of reducing that authority are now asking us to take their audit back. And we unfortunately don't have the capacity at this point either. So what we really need to see is that we're going to have to focus. Like others have said, this won't be a silver bullet, but it is part of a focusing in a time of shortage. We're going to have to look at technology to help us out. We're going to need to focus our regulations, our audits, our oversight requirements to focus on what works best. And here it was another way to focus on what works best. Right now, most of my auditors came in under the old requirement and so did not need to have the extra 30 credits. And they are incredible. They got their expertise through experience. And then I did also ask my new members, my new employees too, because as you know, some of you know, as a former educator, I have, I think, sat in this very chair and spoke against changing licensure requirements for teachers. So naturally, when this came up, I thought, oh my goodness, I'm checking in. I'm not going to get crosswise with my people. And I'm asked, well, is this going to feel insulting? Is this going to feel like we're cutting quality? Does it look like we're just trying to cut your pay? What does this look like? Does it look that? They said, no, pay's going up. That's fine. And also, even the new people said, it's got to change. It's got to change. It's extra 30 credits, not nearly as valuable as even the first 6 months I spent here. So I believe this is a way, again, to help us focus on what works best in a way that addresses a shortage. And I think it will help not only our local entities, but oversight across the country. Thank you.
Thank you, Auditor Blaha. Member questions about the exciting world of accountancy? All right. Representative Davis, and then we'll go to Representative Kraft.
Just one, Mr. Chair. Representative Van Binbergen, why did you have such a lack of testifiers today?
We'll take that more as a comment. Well done. Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Van Binbergen, so as a first-termer, one might be concerned that, you know, you could come to the committee and throw a brick or an air ball. But it seems like you've put on a full court press with all of your testifiers and have brought us something that seems like a slam dunk. So thank you and good luck to your son.
Thank you.
Okay. I really don't know what to say there. Okay, and that's rare. Any other member comments, questions? Representative Anderson?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And Representative, very good bill. I think there's strong support for the bill. We've even heard in agriculture that there's needs for more CPAs and such. So congratulations. And good luck tonight.
All right. Co-Chair Cleburne.
Thank you very much. And I'd like to thank you and also Representative Hewitt for the great work that you've done to get this bill in a space where I can support it. I've held back and held back on this. And so I want to just thank you and the Board of Accountancy and the State Auditor for working collaboratively to make sure that we can ensure both the adequate number of CPAs that we need in our state, and more importantly, the high standard that Minnesotans expect. So I just want to thank you for the good work on this. And then maybe to Representative Anderson, or Chair Anderson, maybe this will help us with our grain buyers. So thank you.
Okay, thank you, Co-Chair Cleburne, for pointing out that this no longer will have a technical foul. So the chair will renew the motion to have House File 1458 as amended, and we are sending this to Ways and Means. All in favor? Aye. Opposed? Congratulations. You are on your way.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Have a great day.
Okay. Next, we have House File 2063, Representative Schultz. As you are not a member of the committee, I will move your bill, House File 2063, to come before the committee. And I believe, Representative Schultz, you have an oral amendment that you'd like to engross. Mr. Colby, Ms. Sullivan, if you could just take the testifier table so we can make sure that we have it properly formatted. So as that's happening, Representative Schultz, if you would like to explain, I'm giving him time to get there, explain your oral amendment. There he is.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll just quickly note that in bringing this bill before the body, we identified a few key, I'm going to call them technical issues that we can just quickly fix on the fly that would get this bill in the shape that would work best for its full implementation. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Would you like to describe where we're doing that, and we'll have Mr. Sullivan corroborate that we can engross those into the bill?
Yes, absolutely, Mr. Chair. On lines 1.10, after it says, so 215 men were killed or injured. We're going to add or injured following the word killed. And then on line 1.17, we are going to delete after fly the Minnesota Historical Society and insert A before replica.
Mr. Sullivan, if you could make sure that we have those properly engrossed, you know.
Mr. Chair and members, yes, those changes will properly engross. The changes, again, are page 1, line 10, before the first period, insert, or injured. And on page 1, line 17, delete the Minnesota Historical Societies and insert a.
Very good. Members, any questions to the oral amendment? Okay, this is to put the bill in the shape that the author would like. All in favor? Aye. Opposed? Okay. That oral amendment is adopted. Representative Schultz, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We stand in Minnesota on the history and the legacy of the people who came before us. And even just this morning, I was greeted by someone who gets to work in these halls representing union folks who came to me and said, generations ago in their family, there was a member of their family who lies here in St. Paul and served in the 1st Minnesota. And the 1st Minnesota Volunteer Infantry saved the Union, the Battle of Gettysburg. And so today we have an opportunity to continue to support that legacy by honoring them with July 2nd being officially named 1st Minnesota Day, and providing that the governor would issue a proclamation to honor this observance and to encourage schools across our state to have instruction and curriculum that will ensure that future generations of Minnesotans understand the relevance of the service of the 1st Minnesota, and to have a replica of the flag of the 1st Minnesota Regiment flown over the state capitol on July 2nd of every year on the north flagpole of the Minnesota state capitol. So with that, that is what the bill does, Mr. Chair. But today, I brought with me Major Olson, who is also has a master's in military history and a focus on the American Civil War, to explain the relevance of the 1st Minnesota.
Representative Olson, welcome to the committee, and I will say, while we both share a great, deep, and abiding love for the Civil War history, brevity is always at a premium.
Chair Nash always does that to me, always does that. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I think it's important to understand that the Battle of Gettysburg was the culminating event of the American Civil War, and what the 1st Minnesota did on the second day of battle was what saved the United States during that battle. I don't think you can press upon that enough. You hear from the movie Gettysburg, if you've ever seen it, you see that a lot of focus is placed on the 20th Maine, right? They were on the little round top on the far left of the battle. And everyone says that their charge down the hill kept Longstreet's men from rolling them up and moving forward. But what would have happened had the Union caved on that far flank? They probably would have just withdrawn and fallen back, and the entire army would not have been destroyed. But what the 1st Minnesota did in the center of the line was to prevent the Confederacy from breaking our entire line in half. Now, what happens when your line is broken in half? The enemy is then able to roll you up on both sides. And what we saw during the Battle of Chickamauga, had it not been for George Thomas, the Rock of Chickamauga, the entire Union Army could have been destroyed at that battle. But instead, he held firm and was able to reconstitute his army and save the day there. But had the Union not plugged the line with the 1st Minnesota, had 262 men not decided to charge into 1,200 Alabamans to buy five more minutes, had that not happened,
there is a great chance that the Confederacy would have broken the lines there on the second day of the Battle of Gettysburg and at least destroyed half of the Union Army, at least half, depending on which way they would have rolled it up. So it is very important that we understand the sacrifice that was made. There's only one other unit in history, in American history, that has lost more or a higher percentage of casualties in one day. So we lost 83% casualties in that charge. 262 men charged into battle, 47 came out unscathed, 83% casualties. That's the second highest of any American unit in all of history. So their sacrifice, their willingness to go forth and save the Union, knowing what was going to happen, for those of you who know math well enough, 262 versus 1,200, those are not good odds. They fixed their bayonets, they charged, and they saved the state of Minnesota, they saved the Union, and they deserve our honor and recognition today. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Olson. We will then have Mr. Kelleher. Mr. Kelleher, as you know, please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm David Kelleher from the Minnesota Historical Society. I cannot top that. I just wanted to add a few words of how we would implement this. And it's fine. There are a number of days of recognition in state statute. But if we don't do something about it, and as the bill suggests, teach school children about the importance of this, then it doesn't make a huge difference. Mr. Chair, the good news is that we have some tools in the toolbox already to help educators and school kids understand this. And Mr. Chair, you're going to say, yep, he's got the book again.
I knew you would.
And I do. And the reason I do is because Northern Lights, which we talked about last week as the curriculum for sixth graders to learn about Minnesota studies, Minnesota history, has a whole chapter on the Civil War. Students may learn about the Civil War in their U.S. history class, but they also will learn about it in their Minnesota studies class. And there's a specific section where students can learn about Charlie Goddard, who was a member, a very, very young member of the First Minnesota. And they can learn through primary source documents about his experience in the Civil War and the Battle of Gettysburg. So the bill calls for us to, all of us, to recognize the First Minnesota and educators to work to make sure that there's understanding. There are many other ways. Our online encyclopedia, Minipedia, has a section on the First Minnesota, and of course, the source of information about the First Minnesota is Richard Moe, who's a Minnesotan who became the head of the National Trust for Historic Preservation. His book is the source of information on the First Minnesota. So lots of resources, and it's a really, really important topic. And thank you, Representative Schultz, for bringing it to everyone's attention.
Thank you, Mr. Kelleher, and I'll take great joy in pointing out that Representative Olson failed to point out that the very building that we are in is an homage or a testament to what happened with the First Minnesota in the Civil War. So he's shaking his head at me, recognizing that had he been given more time, he probably would have gotten there. But it is a very important topic, and I do think school children across the state of Minnesota really need to know these things, because history does matter, and I believe everybody should have gotten their History Matters button. But history does matter, and this is an intensely important topic. So Representative Schultz, we'll go to member questions for you. Any member questions? Once, twice, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And there must have been something about that movie Gettysburg, because it sounds like it meant a lot to both Representative Olson and myself. And since he and I are like only a month or two apart in age, it was critical to my own understanding of Minnesota's role in this history. I grew up watching, that was my single favorite movie growing up, was watching Gettysburg. And at age 9, it was the first time that I had the chance to travel to Gettysburg to see the stories and the history, not just of Minnesotans, but of every American who helped save the Union during that three-day battle. And so I very much appreciate the chance to have this bill before the committee, and thank you for your support.
Thank you, Representative Schultz. For those that saw the movie but didn't read the book, it's Killer Angels by Shara, and it's a very excellent read. So I will, with that, House File 2063 is laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you all. All right. Next on the list, we have Representative Schwartz with House File 2164. Too many bills, starting with two. All right. As you are not a member of the committee, I will move House File 2164 to come before the committee, and you have a familiar testifier.
Yes.
And I'm going to point out that you brought treats, and I commend you for bringing summer sausage. This is one of my favorite things.
Good morning,
To your bill.
Yeah. Good morning, everybody. Good morning, Chair and members. The summer sausage actually comes from the meat market in my hometown of Nicollet in Nicollet County. So I just wanted to share that.
Please proceed.
Okay. So this morning I bring forth House File 2164, and this bill designates St. Peter as the honorary state capital of Minnesota. While Minnesota state capital is located in St. Peter, and in St. Paul and not in St. Peter, there's a historical connection to St. Peter that it was a contender for the state capital. And some even say it was nearly defeated by St. Paul. To my right, I have Ed Lee here, Executive Director of
Tourism Bureau, Chamber of Commerce.
Chamber of Commerce here. Go ahead.
Oh, yeah. Thank you so much, Chair Nash.
If you would, please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Absolutely. My name is Ed Lee, and I am the Executive Director of the Tourism Bureau of St. Peter and also the Chamber of Commerce of St. Peter. And it's a real honor to be here. I've never gotten to do this before. I'm 60 years old. I barely wear a suit, and I even got a haircut. So I'm a little nervous, obviously, but very thankful, Representative Nash and members of the committee, and Representative Schwartz and Senator Frentz, Representatives Paul Torkelson and Bjorn Olson, also for presenting this bill. We love history tourism. There's so much talk in this room this morning about history and keeping history alive. The story in a 11-second nutshell is about a legislator named Joe Rolette, and he was from Northwest Minnesota. St. Peter had the bill, or had the votes to pass the bill that would make St. Peter the state capital in the mid-1850s. Now, Joe Rolette from Northwest Minnesota didn't like that idea. Maybe it was he would have to travel farther, something like that. But he stole the bill and hid out in St. Paul hotels playing poker, drinking whiskey, and managed to keep the bill from being signed, and it fell through the cracks. And the next year, it didn't have the votes to pass. So we might be sitting in St. Peter right now if Joe Rolette had not spirited away that bill. We are not asking you to move to St. Peter. We know you love St. Paul. We love St. Paul. We are asking for a designation today to be the honorary state capital. It's important for tourism, just as the Jesse James Days is in Northfield. Anything that we can do, any tools that we can use to attract people from the five-state area to our region, we want to use that. And that's what we're asking for. Please do it. Please support this bill. Thank you again to Representative Schwartz.
Welcome back to the committee, Representative Olson. If you would proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that especially the floor leaders here in this committee would like to know some of the intricacies of how this actually slipped through the cracks. Because in 1857, when we were still a territory, the United States government said that the state of Minnesota, or the territory of Minnesota, is going to meet in St. Paul, but they didn't designate where the capital was going to be. And so as they were deliberating upon where it was going to be, a lot of people thought it was going to be St. Paul. The people in St. Paul didn't take the threat of St. Peter seriously, and there was potentially some money to be made with the territorial governor. Some of the senators and some of the representatives were looking at making some big cash if they could move the capital to St. Peter. They had some substantial holdings in St. Peter that they were willing to offload. And so they had the votes to make this pass through the government. And what happened is as they were progressing through, they made it through all their committee stops. They made it off the floor. And what happened at that point, as we all know, is that you have to make sure that the bills are same and similar. And the individual who was in charge of determining whether the two bills from the Senate and the House were same and similar was this Joe Rowlett. And he looked at this and he says, I don't like this idea. The fact of the matter was is that they had passed it. The governor was going to sign this because he had substantial holdings in St. Peter. So Joe decided that he was going to abdicate from the Capitol. He was going to run off, and he deposited the documents with a banker, making sure that the bill was held safe in a bank. He then went to the hotel where he was staying, and he said, I'm going to switch rooms. He switched to the top floor of the room. He told the owner of the hotel, he said, anyone who's coming asking for me, tell them I left and I went home. And so the sergeant at arms actually would go off and try to find him in his hometown. But here's where the rules really stuck him. In the Senate, there was a rule that said if you have a call of the Senate, you needed a 3/5 vote to end it, and they didn't have that. And so essentially, just as years ago we heard the chief clerk say Torkelson, 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 for days and days they were in gridlock looking for Rowlett, and they could not end the call of the House because it took more than a majority. And these individuals who wanted it to be in St. Peter just had a majority. They didn't have a supermajority to end this rule. So that's why rules really matter. As days and days went on, it was a little over a week that he was hanging out in this upstairs of the hotel where no one could find him, except we know that the sergeant at arms who was supposed to be going and finding him actually knew where he was, but was sending couriers up to his hometown trying to find him in his hometown, knowing that he was in the top of the hotel room. But this was a ploy by the St. Paul delegation to make sure that it stayed in St. Paul. At the end of the day, right as session was ending, he ran into the floor right as they were about to adjourn, sine die at the end of session. He runs in, he says, these two bills are not similar. There are errors and they must be changed. And then time was up. They weren't able to make the House and the Senate version same and similar, and thus ended St. Peter's bid to be the capital of the state of Minnesota. So it's a tragic loss for those of us in southern Minnesota. It's also a tragic loss for the territorial governor, who is going to make some serious cash. And they did try a ploy to sign it anyways and make it happen. But at that point in time, they had the speaker signed it. The senator or the governor signed that bill after the fact. But the Senate president refused to sign it at that point in time, as he probably should have, because time was out. So make sure that your rules are good, that you can end a call of the House with less than a supermajority, and you'll be all right, and you'll be able to move the Capitol to St. Peter. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Olson. For those that have never been in room 123, there is a giant painting of, what's that?
I think it's
123, actually. And there's a picture of Mr. Rowlett in that room, and it's a great story of sort of subterfuge and intrigue. I do believe we have one other testifier who is going to be coming in remotely. Do you have? So I believe we have Dustin Sharstrom, a city council member from St. Peter. We will get you put into the committee.
Hi, can you guys hear me?
Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
My name is Dustin Sharstrom. I'm a social studies teacher in St. Peter, and I'm currently Zooming in from my classroom. I also serve on the St. Peter City Council, and I'm an adjunct social studies professor at Gus Davis College.
Thank you. Please proceed.
Awesome. So listening to the conversations about St. Peter being the honorary capital, I'm very proud as a history teacher to hear that everything has accurately been conveyed. And when looking at this, no, making St. Peter the honorary capital isn't changing history. It's not revisionist history. It's just simply acknowledging what happened in the past and allowing St. Peter to have a greater conversation about our role in our own history. I would like to point out that the territorial governor at the time was a gentleman named Willis Gorman. And Gorman Park is one of our feature parks in St. Peter. It would be such an honor to our own history for us to be able to put a sign up at that park speaking of the history. So when kids walk down from St. Peter Middle School or South Elementary or North Elementary, they can see that when they go play at the park in St. Peter.
Is that all your testimony, or did we lose you?
That is it. Other than simply wanting to commend my students for sitting so quietly and allow them to say hello quickly.
Hello.
All right. We're doing legislative business, and we're educating the children at the same time.
Absolutely.
Okay, let's go to member questions. Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As a former resident of St. Peter and Augusta, I do appreciate the designation. I also will say, you know, not to be Debbie Downer, but I do wish we were covering some more meaty topics in committee today. But that said, St. Peter is a lovely town. I appreciate the bill. Thank you.
President Freiberg.
Thank you. I guess I'm just curious exactly, I mean, the bill is one sentence long. It says the city of St. Peter is the honorary capital of the state of Minnesota. I guess I'm just curious for the bill authors, what is an honorary capital, and does it confer any special rights to St. Peter? I Googled honorary capital, and I wasn't able to find any other examples of that, so I'm just kind of unfamiliar with the concept.
Representative Schwartz.
Just to highlight, this bill to me would just be to highlight the history behind St. Peter and just give it the honorary, that the title per se for St. Peter.
Representative Freiberg.
All right, I think I'm good. Thanks.
Very well. Anybody else? Co-Chair Cleburne, any comments? Nope. Okay. Then Representative Schwartz to conclude your bill.
Thank you. When I decided to accept the candidacy and run, I learned the history behind St. Peter, and that's what attracted me to this bill. I think highlighting the history that lies within St. Peter, St. Peter is also the city and the county seat of Nicollet County, where I reside and raise my family. St. Peter is also home to the famous Gustavus Adolphus College, and hopefully soon the honorary state capital. Thank you.
Very well. With that, Chair, I don't need to renew a motion. We will be laying 2164 over. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay. Do I just want to do this from here, or do I want to have Ben do it? I'm just going to move these two bills that I've authored, and I'm not going to go to the test fires table. I'll just do it from here. These are vehicle bills, and Co-Chair Cleburne and I have talked about these. They're are no objections. We're going to be laying them over. So Chair moves House File 927 to come before the committee. This is in consultation with the LCC. We have identified some of the commissions that are no longer being utilized, and this is the Legislative Commission on Housing Affordability. It was not renewed, and it is sitting on the books, and it has really no purpose at all. So we'll be both doing this, but also retaining this in committee as a vehicle bill once we lay it over. Any questions? This does not have to go to transportation. Excellent question, though. Resident Freiberg.
Does it have to go to housing?
It does not have to go to housing. Anybody else want to try to stump the chair? Anyone? Anyone? With that, House File 927 is laid over for possible inclusion. Chair will then move House File 1059 to come before the committee. We will be laying this bill over as well, and this will be repealing the Legislative COVID-19 Response Commission. Once again, same story as before. Co-Chair Cleburne and I have discussed this. It's going to be another vehicle bill, but also fulfills what I had said as requests from the LCC to clean up their books. To take some of the things off of that. So any questions? And no, it doesn't have to go to housing or transportation or health. Anyone else? Okay, with that, House File 1059 is laid over. All right, moving along. Now we have House File 1910. Co-Chair Cleburne, would you like to move your bill?
I move House File 1910 to be before the committee, and I move that this bill is also a vehicle bill and that we just laid over for possible inclusion.
Okay, would you like to describe your bill?
Yeah, it just adds a vice chair to the, it just says that there will be a chair and a vice chair for the commission, and that will, it will move between House and Senate.
Member questions?
For the Legislative Coordinating Commission.
No questions, no re-referrals. With that, House File 1910 is laid over for possible inclusion. Chair Cleavorn, would you like to move House File 2232 to come before the committee?
I do. I move House File 2232, and I'll go to the testifiers table.
Okay. As Chair Cleavorn moves to the testifiers table, we have some testifiers coming forward. Chair Cleavorn, to your bill.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. This is a bill which was brought to us by admin to clean up the Department of Administration's state contracting. And the bill does three main things. First, it adds clarity and transparency regarding contract terms that conflict with state law, the state constitution, or best practices. Second, it applies to subcontracting requirements to all prime contractors, including those in disadvantaged area, or those who are veteran-owned. And finally, it eliminates the underutilized data analytics master program. We did have the State Board of Investment come to us and say that there was a little concern that they had, so we do have an oral amendment to clean up that concern. And I Mr. Mule,
yeah, Mr. Sullivan's going to come to the table to walk us through the oral amendment.
And would you like Mr. Mule to explain the concern that they had also?
We can. Once we get to the oral amendment and engross it, we can have the testifier talk about the rationale for it. Mr. Sullivan, if you would, walk through the oral amendment that both Chair Cleavorn and I have agreed to engross on her behalf.
And Mr. Chair and members, the amendment to House File 2232 is on page 1, after line 5, insert Section 1, contracts, Section 16C.05, Subdivision 8, Paragraph A, Clauses 2 and 5 do not apply to contracts entered into by the State Board of Investment related to an investment under this section. And then the commands that follow along with that insertion are to renumber the sections in sequence and correct the internal references and amend the title accordingly.
Okay, members, did we all track that? All right, so the oral amendment is to put the bill in the shape that the author wishes. All in favor? Aye. Opposed? The oral amendment is adopted. Chair Cleavorn, to your bill as amended.
Okay. Do the committee members want to know why we made that change?
Please.
Yes. All right, Mr. Mule.
Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Good morning, Chair Nash and members. My name is John Mulay. I'm the General Counsel and Legislative Liaison for the Minnesota State Board of Investment. So broadly speaking, we think the clarity in this bill is great. It will help us a great deal in our investment negotiations. There were a couple of wrinkles we felt needed to be addressed. We have a portion of our portfolio invested in what are called commingled investments, which are largely limited partnerships, but they function kind of like a mutual fund where a lot of investors are putting their money into a similar strategy, and then you have a general partner that is managing the fund. In those cases, there are certain aspects of the investment contract that apply to all investors and are very difficult to change for an individual investor. The two parts that we identified were the choice of law provision. The bill would require Minnesota law to apply to all the contracts entered into by the state. That is very difficult in the partnership context. A lot of times the law that is going to apply is going to be either Delaware law or New York law where the partnerships are based. The other provision we had slight concerns about was the prohibition on unilateral amendments by a third party contracting with the state. While in general we think that principle is very important, there are certain discrete instances in which we've allowed general partners to make unilateral amendments to make sure that the fund is working as best as possible for the limited partners or investors that are in it. So that is the genesis of those two exemptions. The rest of the provisions we think are really, really good.
Thank you very much for explaining the rationale for the oral amendment. Chair Cleburne, I believe you have a testifier, Rachel Dougherty. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Good morning. My name is Rachel Dougherty. I am Enterprise Contracts Counsel with the Office of State Procurement.
Please proceed with your testimony. Microphones are great.
Mr. Chair, first, there are a number of standard terms in commercial contracts that are incredibly difficult for the state to agree to, as they either are prohibited by the state constitution or state statute, or can cause the state to come into conflict with these constitutional and statutory provisions. This legislation provides notice to suppliers of these terms by centralizing them in 16C and requiring that the Office of State Procurement post notice of the statute on their website. This bill will streamline and expedite the state's contract negotiation process, allowing focus on scope of work and payment terms rather than an extended back and forth on terms and conditions the state either cannot or should not agree to. It is protective of the state by ensuring that a state entity does not inadvertently bind the state to contract terms by voiding the term while still preserving the business relationship with our partners. It is also protective of the state in circumstances where negotiation is not feasible, such as click-through agreements, which are increasingly common. An example of such clause is a term that requires mandatory arbitration, which is an unknown expense by its very nature, which an agency may not have funds for. Such a term conflicts with the Minnesota Constitution, Article 11, which asserts that the state cannot agree to a financial obligation without an appropriation. This may also violate Minnesota Statute 16A as an obligation in excess of an appropriation. And last, it could come into conflict with the Attorney General Office's role directing the legal business of the state. Now, moving on to the next part of the bill, it applies subcontracting requirements to all prime contractors. This promotes fairness, and all prime contractors would be subject to the same goal-setting requirements. And last, this bill would eliminate the requirement that the Office of State Procurement hold a data analytics enterprise contract program. The program is underutilized, as the same services are available through another enterprise contract program that the Office of State Procurement maintains. Eliminating the requirement allows the Office of State Procurement to focus efforts on more productive and advantageous enterprise contract programs. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Member questions for the bill author or testifiers? We are not an inquisitive bunch this morning. Chair Cleburne, to your bill as amended.
Members of the committee, this is a really good bill, and it's an important piece of state contracting that we need to clean up. So I just ask for your support.
Very good. And with that, House File 2232 as amended is laid over for inclusion. Members, that is our full agenda for the day. With that, we are adjourned.